You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, September 19th, the Feast of St. Januarius. Coming up in about 15 minutes, conversation I've been looking forward to, the author of the book Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World, Shadi Hamid, who is a senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution and a contributing writer for The Atlantic, also the author of Temptations, Power, Islamists and Liberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Hamid lives in Washington, D.C., and his book is published by St. Martin's Press. I really read an initial article based on his book in the journal The Atlantic, and it made me very curious, and so I reached out, and he was gracious enough to be on the program today, and I think he has a perspective shaped by time spent in the Middle East, as well as his own background as a Muslim, in terms of helping maybe correct some of the misconceptions, misperceptions that are out there. As far as I see it, views on Islam, and particularly ISIS, tend to gravitate toward one of two extremes. One is the idea that ISIS is simply the expression of what Islam intrinsically is by its very nature, and yes, maybe they're bloodier and more aggressive, but really all Islam is oriented toward violent conquering of foes and the ruling of others. Then there's the other extreme that basically says ISIS has nothing to do with Islam. It's all about power. It's all about economics and so forth. It's some sort of a distortion or corruption, not true Islam. And I think typically both those are extremes that go from one ditch to the other. And so I want to talk to Mr. Hamid about that in the next section, and segment on the program, next two segments. And if you've got a question or a comment, you're certainly welcome to send me an email, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or when the time is right, you can call 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. Today, the feast day of St. Januarius, who was a bishop and a martyr. As says here on CatholicCulture.com, little is known about St. Januarius. He was bishop of Benevento in Campania. He died near Naples. These are all in Italy, of course, about the year 305. He was martyred under the persecution of the emperor Diocletian. Around the year 400, the relics of St. Januarius were moved to Naples, which honors Januarius as the patron saint. There is an alleged miracle of Januarius at least three times a year on his feast day, also on December 16th and the first Sunday of May, the sealed vial with his congealed blood in it liquefies, froths and bubbles up. We Catholics, we like our relics, right? So there's some blood of St. Januarius, and three times a year, and the blood liquefies, froths, and bubbles up. It has occurred every year with rare exceptions. The thing I'd note about the story of St. Januarius, as I said, of which most people know very little, bishop and martyr, is, you know, he was a victim of a season of persecution in the life of the church through the in the first three centuries. As I've said before on the program, and a good friend of mine, Rod Stern, who is a historian, likes to point out, we sometimes misunderstand the persecution of the earliest Christians as though martyrdom was a regular, consistent occurrence within the Roman Empire. And the truth is there were seasons of persecution and martyrdom and seasons of relative tranquility and then seasons and so forth. So a lot of depend upon maybe either who the emperor was or even who sort of the local Roman governor was, depending on what one's experience of persecution was. But the period in which St. Januarius was martyred was a particularly difficult time for Christians,
under Emperor Diocletian. I think the thing that's notable here, in 305 AD, Januarius was martyred. 8 years later, 313 AD, under Roman emperors Constantine I and Licinius, the Edict of Milan was issued, which permanently established religious toleration for Christianity within the Roman Empire. Now, we could say a cliche, right, that it's always darkest before the dawn. Certainly is not always true. We always have to be careful of our assumptions about history. I'm sure Shadi Hamid will talk to us a little bit about that in the next couple of segments, assumptions we make about Islam, about liberal secularism, and all the rest. But sometimes we make the mistake of assuming in the midst of our hand-wringing, not that suffering that we face is not real or anything like that, but we have to be very careful that we don't assume we know the future. I doubt the Christians who suffered under brutal persecution under Emperor Diocletian could have possibly imagined that within 20 years, not only would Christianity be tolerated, but it would be the official religion of the Roman Empire, and that Constantine himself would compel the first the first Council of Nicaea that clarified the church's understanding of the identity of Jesus and refuted the heresy of Arianism. How difficult that would have been to imagine. It's easy through the lens of history to look back. So I guess what I'm saying is, if you think things are particularly dark right now for Christians, whether it's in places in the world where there is great persecution, and it is dark, no question about it. Our friend and regular guest John Allen has done a really yeoman's work in helping us see the suffering that Christians are enduring in places all over this world. And we also have concerns about the usurpation of religious freedom happening even here in the States. But if you think things are on a trajectory that cannot be changed, St. Januarius is a reminder of different things indeed. And so we pray, St. Januarius, pray for us. And if you've got a question or a comment, 573-4BREAD-4. I'm asking a question of the day based on the Diocese of Camden, New Jersey. Diocese of Camden, New Jersey has issued a decree, or they did several weeks ago, that any of their Catholic high school athletes who don't stand for the national anthem are subject to a 2-game suspension. And I ask the question, do you agree with that? And you're certainly free still to chime in if you want. Call or text me, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. In other words, with everything going on with Colin Kaepernick's very public stand that he would not stand for the national anthem, and I guess some local public schools there in the Camden area having athletes who in unison, football teams, refuse to stand in protest of particular concerns about oppression and injustices done to African Americans. So the Catholic Diocese, I guess, being proactive and letting its athletes know the expectation is that you stand for respect for the flag, and if you don't, being the fact that you are in a private school and therefore you compete at the whim and the discretion of those who of these Catholic schools, then you can be suspended. So my question is, do you agree with that? A couple of other comments we got here. Shayla says, absolutely I do. They get to live and grow up in a country where they have the freedoms they do because of others making the ultimate sacrifice for that said freedom. It's a matter of honor, respect, and thanks to those who have served and currently do serve. She says, I applaud the Diocese of Camden for standing up for what is the proper thing to do and to make it clear what will happen if they don't, as they are expected to do. If you have a disagreement, there are other ways to get involved. Make your voice heard. Allison says, yes, I do. I think everyone should stand for the national anthem to show respect for our country and those who have fought and continue to fight for our freedom. Dana says, yes, we've all got to start taking a stand. No more weak knees Catholics. We all know the results of that. Chelsea, who is a regular guest on the program, Chelsea Zimmerman, posting something from the 1943 United States Supreme Court that ruled in West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett that government officials cannot force anyone to participate in patriotic rituals, including the Pledge of Allegiance. No public school employee, no teacher, vice principal, coach, or superintendent can legally force you to say the pledge. She says, while maybe not specifically about the national anthem, I still agree with this. So I'm guessing that Chelsea would be a vote to the negative in terms of her views of the Diocese of Camden. We didn't have a chance to get to this in the first hour. Let's really quickly look at a few things that happened in history on this date throughout the ages. September 19th over the years. 1796, George Washington gave his farewell address as president on this day. 1881, James Garfield died of wounds inflicted by an assassin. On this day, 105 years ago, Sir William Golding, author of the novel Lord of the Flies, was born. In 1936, happy birthday, 80th to Al Order. Al Order, who won the gold medal, I believe, in the discus in 1956, 1960, 1964, 1968. Joe Morgan's birthday today, the great second baseman, really one of the great second basemen to ever play the game for the Big Red Machine of the Cincinnati Reds, 73 years old today. The Twist hit number one in 1960, 56 years ago. My mother's just graduated from high school. She could still do the Twist, let me tell you. And on this day in 1970, the Mary Tyler Moore Show debuted on CBS. Who can turn the world on with her smile? We'll be back in a minute on the other side of the break with my guest, Shadi Hamid, author of Islamic Exceptionalism. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media on this Monday, September 19th. Pleased to have with us from Washington, D.C., Shadi Hamid. He's a senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution and a contributing writer for The Atlantic. He's also the author of Temptations of Power, Islamists and a Liberal Democracy in a New Middle East. As I said, he lives in Washington. We're here to talk about his book out from St. Martin's Press, Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Good morning, Mr. Hamid.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So what motivated you to write this book?
So, you know, a lot has happened over the past 5 years or so. So I was in Tahrir Square when the Arab Spring was happening, and to see a dictator fall and to be there in that moment. And that was really, that was an optimistic time for a lot of us who work on the Middle East. But over the past few years, you know, you have the collapse of the Arab Spring, the rise of ISIS, civil war in Iraq and Syria. And increasingly, I wanted to make sense of the broader picture. And, you know, having spent six of the last 12 years of my life in the Middle East, you know, I came to realize more and more that religion really matters. And I wanted in this book to sort of bring religion back into the conversation, but in a way that was nuanced and constructive, not sort of the stereotypical Islam is bad, Sharia is taking over the world kind of thing. And I think also I went through a change myself where I began to appreciate more and more the power and relevance of religion in the minds and hearts of believers, and to see kind of how religion and politics are endlessly intertwined. And that's really how this book sort of, came to fruition for me.
Now, a lot of people, I'm sure, talk about your title, Islamic Exceptionalism, and but you argue that the phrase exceptionalism is really a neutral statement in and of itself, because you're talking about simply what is, and in that regard, on issues of religion and politics, you say Islam is just different.
Exactly. So, I mean, part of what I try to do in my work in general is suspend my own personal ideological inclination. So, you know, I'm an American small L liberal. I myself am skeptical of the role of religion in politics, you know, here in the U.S. and just generally. But I think that regardless of what you and I feel, it's up to everyone to make their own choice. And if there are millions of people in the Middle East, really tens of millions or even hundreds of millions, who believe that Islam should play a prominent role in politics, we have to do our best to understand where that's coming from. And, you know, I also don't like this idea that we have as, you know, Northeastern liberal elites. I live in D.C. and that's sort of the world that I live in, that religion is necessarily a negative force in public life. So whenever we hear about people expressing their religion in public life, or we hear about evangelicals or Sharia law or, you know, Orthodox Judaism in Israel, that's automatically, people are going too far. But religion can play a very negative role, as we've seen in the Middle East over the past few years, but it can also play a constructive role. And we have to look at one from one context to another. And obviously, also in different countries, Islam manifests itself in public life in very different ways. So I think being attuned to those kinds of specifics are important. At the same time, I'm well aware that the argument that I'm making in the book is provocative in some ways. I'm arguing that Islam is fundamentally different than other major religions and how it relates to law, politics, and governance. But we have to unpack what that really means in practice.
Yeah, it seems, and I don't know whether you agree with this, but in America, we tend to vary between two extremes, particularly when you look at a group like ISIS, for example. There are those on the one hand who want to say, and I think our president would be in this group, who sees ISIS as having nothing to do with Islam. It is simply about power or material economic concerns and so forth. It's a distortion of what true Islam is. And then you have those on the other extreme who say this is maybe a more radical manifestation, but at its core, this is what Islam is. It's about violence. It's about conquering and subjugation. And it seems like both those are poles you're trying to avoid.
Yeah. So usually when you have two extremes like that, the truth is somewhere in between, right? So I think that it really troubles me. President Obama's well-intentioned in this regard. He's trying to push back against anti-Muslim bigotry, which is obviously a big problem in our country now with the rise of Trump. So I think he goes out of his way to diminish the role of religion. But I don't think it's just about him pushing back. I think people like President Obama are uncomfortable with the language of religion and ideology and how that can really motivate people. And that's a bigger thing that I try to address in the book, that when we see people acting in problematic or violent ways in the Middle East and beyond, we always want to think that, you know, they're doing it for totally non-religious reasons. So ISIS can't possibly believe that what they're saying is true. And the idea there is that they're using religion. But what they really want is power, control, and domination. So, you know, I don't doubt, and as an American Muslim myself, I think that ISIS distorts and perverts my religion. But that doesn't mean that they don't believe that what they're doing is right and commanded by God. And I think that we have to take it seriously that ISIS fighters and leaders, most if not all of them, are driven by what they perceive to be the truth. And I think that if we don't really take that into account, we can't fully understand our enemy. And I also think that when we're talking to the broader American public and we say things like, oh, hey, ISIS has nothing to do with Islam, a lot of ordinary Americans are going to think to themselves, wait, are these guys crazy? Or are they not speaking frankly with us? Because they can see watching TV every day that religion has something to do with it. I think that's intuitive to a lot of people. And if we tell them no, religion has nothing to do with it, I think we undermine our own credibility.
We're talking with Shadi Hamid, the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. You mentioned being present at Tahrir Square during the so-called Arab Spring or the early days of it. How did that experience there shape you and even shape the context of this book?
So, look, I mean, it was a beautiful moment. And, you know, to be there when the announcement was made that President Mubarak, the dictator of 30 years, had fallen, and to kind of see it dawn on people and then the hundreds of thousands of people in Tahrir Square just erupting in these deafening cheers, like it was a very inspiring moment. And that, for me, watching it, was really the peak of that particular period. And I think it captured what a lot of Americans watching from their homes were thinking, that, hey, here's a new era for the Middle East. But that's what makes it so depressing. And that's why those memories have become more and more blurry to me, because, wow, did that really happen? Was there really this moment of unity and optimism in light of what happened afterwards? So the book is sort of colored by this post-Arab Spring pessimism. And what was really striking for me is to see, so I'm born and raised in Pennsylvania, but my parents are Egyptian and most of my relatives are in Egypt. So to see how members of my own family said they weren't thrilled about the Arab Spring for various reasons, but many of them kind of went along with it and they ended up supporting it because that's, you know, the way the wind was blowing. But to see how they turned against democracy just a couple years later and they supported the 2013 military coup against a democratically elected but Islamist government, the government of the Muslim Brotherhood and President Mohamed Morsi. And not only did they support a military coup, they supported the worst mass killing in modern Egyptian history, which happened in August 2013. So about 1,000 people were killed in broad daylight in the matter of hours. So I wanted to sort of, so part of what I wanted to do was to understand this puzzle, is how can people so quickly turn against their fellow countrymen after such a moment of optimism? And for me, a big part of the answer was that what people were debating in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East, it wasn't about policy or politics in the normal sense. It was about something raw and existential. It was about the meaning of the nation state, the role of religion in public life, the question of whether the state should be ideologically or religiously neutral, or should the state support a particular conception of the good life, of the virtuous life. These are very big foundational questions. And they remain unresolved in much of the Middle East, this question of Islam's relationship to the state. So essentially, my relatives supported terrible things because they were afraid, in part, that Islamist parties would keep on winning elections, they would stay in power, and they would change the nature of Egypt. So, you know, it's this question of, and it's a universal question in a way, is how do otherwise good people come to support evil things? And you can't really understand that part of it in the Middle East unless you start to unpack these very basic questions about who people are in their own relationship to the state.
We're here with Shadi Hamid, the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. We're coming up on the end of this segment. Mr. Hamid, can you hold on for a few minutes through the break?
Yes, of course.
All right, fantastic. We'll be back with more. If you've got a question or a comment, 5734-BREAD-4. You can call or text or shoot me an email, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We'll be back in just a minute here on The Mike Allen Show. This is Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Here with my guest from Washington, D.C., Shadi Hamid, the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. He is a senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution and a contributing writer for The Atlantic as well. Mr. Hamid, thanks for holding on during the break.
Yeah, my pleasure.
One of the things I think you do throughout this book is you take issue with what you call sort of Western liberal assumptions about the trajectory of history and perhaps the inevitable victory of secularism, and also the fact that democracy, by its very nature, is going to involve the reduction of faith in public life. You also take issue with the assumptions of even of those who say that, that everybody's the same, they want the same things, including, I think, a comment from Ben Affleck that Muslims bleed just like us, they want to eat sandwiches and raise their children just like we do. Talk about some of those assumptions that you've run across.
Yeah, sure. Well, that whole Ben Affleck, Bill Maher debate was really interesting for me, because on one hand, you have a famous actor who's defending Muslims on national television, which for me was like, wow, we don't see that very often. But at the same time, I think there is this sort of liberal tenet that you hear a lot that, hey, we all ultimately believe in the same things. It's just a matter of time until we all get there. But also this idea that just because, you know, Muslims eat sandwiches and raise kids like everyone else, that means that they can't also support the implementation of Islamic law. I mean, you can believe both of those things simultaneously. And again, that doesn't even mean a harsh version of Islamic law. You can just believe that Islam has something to say about the legal foundations of the state. So again, I think that the better approach is somewhere in between. And I think also, you know, we tend to superimpose this Christian framework and to look at how Christianity evolved. So this idea of, you know, clerical despotism, then you have Reformation, Enlightenment, then you move towards a more secular future, then you end up at the end of history of liberal democracy. And people want to see history as moving in this very linear fashion. And I think that, you know, why should we assume that Islam will follow the same trajectory as Christianity if it is in fact a quite different religion? Obviously, there are some universal principles which all religions share, but, you know, religions are different because they're different. And that's why people believe, you know, what would be the point if all religions were basically the same? And I think that, that's a big problem, and it's so implicit in the way we talk about these issues. And I get this a lot myself, where people are like, hey, the Muslim world or the Middle East is going through a lot of difficulty and violence right now, but don't worry, you guys will get there in due time. You just have to go through what we Westerners went through, and we went through our 30 years war and 100 years war and all that. So I think there's almost something kind of patronizing about that. And there are just so many assumptions that are packed in there. And we have to ask ourselves, why do we assume these things?
Well, there's a degree of condescension, I think, there. Without question. I think one of the things you push is, you know, we have, of course, we saw after the fall of Iraq, of course, and the attempt at nation building and all the rest, this idea, this optimism, this Western optimism that we can sort of import Western-style democracy other places. And you take issue with that. It seems like there are those now who question, okay, is democracy even a possibility in the Middle East, in the Muslim world? But you seem to take a different tack, which is democracy is possible, but if that democracy reflects a majority desire for Islamic rule, we have to be comfortable with that.
Yeah, so, you know, I think part of what we have to challenge is this idea that democracy and small L liberalism go hand in hand. And by small L liberalism, I mean the classical liberal tradition, which emphasizes civil liberties, non-negotiable rights and freedoms, the kind of the role and agency of the individual. And these things are oftentimes in practice in tension with each other, because if you have a majority that is religiously inspired, they may want to have more Islam in public life, not less, and that can affect certain personal freedoms when it comes to things like, you know, blasphemy, alcohol consumption, the relationship between the sexes, in any number of ways. And I think that we even see this to some extent in the West, so it's not a totally foreign thing. So in certain parts of the U.S., on the state level, you have majorities that have pushed against gay marriage, have pushed for the teaching of, you know, of creationism in schools, debates over school prayer. So in a way, all societies have to figure those issues out. And it's really a question of where do you put the red line? And how do you override the Constitution? Because if you have 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 75% of the states, you can, you know, amend the Constitution. So if America was 80% evangelical, presumably that would affect the kinds of laws that people pass. So I think that, but it's more pronounced in the Middle East simply because religion plays more of a role and more people are religious and practicing and quite serious about their religion. So naturally, they're going to want that to be reflected in their political system. So there's a tension there. But if the choice really comes down to a somewhat illiberal democracy to one degree or another, or a brutal so-called secular dictatorship, I think that the choice for me at least is clear that the former is preferable. And it's going to be messy for a while. There's going to be real tensions as people express their religious and ethnic identities. But you have to let the democratic process play out, just like it played out, say, in the U.S., where it took us a long time to work out these tensions.
I think one of the difficulties, and we talked a little bit about this during the commercial break off air, as a Catholic, and, you know, certainly from the perspective of Catholics, and I would say other Christians as well, one of the concerns about the you know, one person's Arab Spring, let's just say, makes another person a Christian, let's say, particularly some of these ancient Christian populations in countries that are predominantly Muslim, like Egypt or, you know, Iraq or Syria, which have, of course, deep Judeo-Christian minority roots as well. There was a concern that at least under a dictator, as less than ideal as that is, there was some degree of religious freedom for Christians and some protections. And the concern under, you know, an Islamist rule, let's say, or a Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or wherever, is that Christians would be at the very least subject to sort of a perpetual kind of demitude, you know, that sort of demi-status, or at the worst, of course, subject to violent repercussions that the government perhaps has little motivation to sort of quell.
Yeah, so that is, I think, one of the tensions, and it's a tough one to address because there's no easy solution. So, but at the same time, I think it's important that we not idealize kind of Christian life under Mubarak. I mean, Mubarak wasn't a disaster for Egyptian Christians, but he also wasn't great. So there was discrimination. There were restrictions on where you could build churches, you know, so on and so forth. But I think that when Christians saw the alternative, which could have been long-term Muslim Brotherhood rule, understandably, they were afraid of that uncertain future. But it's not just even Christians. It's also secularists, people who would define themselves as liberal. All of these people were understandably afraid that their way of life would change. And I think that the only way to really address that is to, you know, for those in the international community, the U.S. and its allies, that during any democratic transition, the issue of minority rights has to be at the top of the agenda. And those, you know, in the U.S. has to say, well, if there are real repercussions for Christians, that would affect, for example, the U.S.-Egypt relationship. And I think that in Syria, you see some of these same issues where the very brutal Assad regime has again kind of promoted itself as a protector of minorities. But at the same time, you also have to say in the case of Syria, the majority in the country are Sunnis, and the country is governed by the minority Alawite sect. So just as we talk about minority rights, we also have to talk about the fact that Sunnis have been oppressed under the minority dictatorship of the Assad regime. And in a way, everyone's been oppressed in the dictatorship of the Assad regime. But, you know, ultimately, the tension between minority rights and majority rights is one that's going to be there. And you just have to hope that over time, people find the right balance.
Well, Mr. Hamid, I think it's certainly an excellent book in terms of pushing people past a sort of monolithic view of Islam. I mean, 1.6 billion people, it's almost impossible to conceive, and many different schools of thought within it, and your book's done a great service there. So we appreciate you taking time for us, and we'll make sure we get the word out about your book.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike. It was a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Thank you. Shadi Hamid from the Brookings Institution. Check out his book, Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. You may not agree with all of it, but it'll certainly make you think. Thanks so much. We'll be back in just a minute with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to learn more about Breadbox Media? Just go to breadboxmedia.com. You can learn all about it, the reason why we exist as a media entity seeking to take through the digital world and across the digital stratosphere and through apps for your digital devices and through streaming and podcasting to bring the truth and the love of Jesus Christ and to talk about the beauty and the richness of the faith he founded upon St. Peter and the Apostles, the Catholic Church, and hopefully answer your questions, but understand we're all on this journey together, and we can lean on each other. So anyway, that's why we exist, and we have contributors from all across the country and across the fruited plain, as they say, all with different perspectives and temperaments. You can check all out, all the programming out at breadboxmedia.com and listen to podcasts. Even subscribe as well through Podbean, Google Play, or iTunes. And you can also become a friend of your favorite show, including if you want to be a friend of this show. I would certainly be happy if you were to do so. If you appreciate this and want to support it, and you'll receive access to exclusive online content. You can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Man, I could have talked to Shadi Hamid for a long, long time about his book, and definitely going to have an excuse to get him back on. Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. I think he gives us, you know, it's always dangerous. I think this is the case. It's always dangerous when we seek to speak for a religion that is not our own. And we make a lot of assumptions about Islam. I think we do as Christians. About the maybe almost monolithic nature of Islam. I mean, we're talking about 1.6 billion people spread across the globe. It's a huge religious movement that's been around for 1,400 years. So there are a lot of different schools of thought. And I think one of the things that Shadi Hamid has done very well in the book is to help us see that all these particular groups, for example, even these sort of socio-political Islamic groups, are not the same. Muslim Brotherhood, very different in its assumptions and goals than ISIS, for example. Because a group like Muslim Brotherhood is what he calls Islamist in the sense that they believe in working within the modern nation state and within
the parliamentary procedures. There we go. To accomplish their ends. In other words, they sort of embrace Western political structures and assumptions in the pursuit of their aims, which is to bring a greater Islamic presence in public life and in governmental life. Whereas a group like ISIS, in trying to reassert the caliphate and all that, have no use for many Western political assumptions. And they have their own particular vision. So that's helpful. What I do think we need more conversation about is, I think, the concerns as, yes, life as a Christian under Mubarak, life as a Christian under Hussein was far from ideal. Yes, there were restrictions on where you could build churches. But you know what? You could build churches in some of these, you know, under the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm not sure in Egypt you would be permitted to build a Christian church. You certainly can't in Saudi Arabia. But then he talks about, you know, Indonesia and Malaysia, which are very interesting places because they're oftentimes lifted up as sort of exemplars of how religious diversity can exist in largely Muslim countries. But as he points out, there's more Sharia law on the books in places like Malaysia and Indonesia, surprisingly, than there are in many other Islamic majority places throughout the world. I think that's the big question from a Christian perspective, is there room within a democratic society that is in which 80-something percent of the residents are Muslim to tolerate Christians to live in the culture in a way that is not basically like the demitude status that Christians have lived under in various places in the world under Islamic rule. So anyway, I think there's a lot to talk about there. And certainly if you want to chime in, 5734BREAD4, I want to have Mr. Hamid back on sometime soon, maybe to address some more of the questions, trying to avoid those, as I said, those extremes on either side, the blanket condemnation of all Muslims, seeing as ISIS is simply just what all Muslims really want at heart, or the parallel opposite, or the contradictory opposite extreme, that ISIS has nothing to do with Islam and is really just about power. I think both those are misguided, and I think Mr. Hamid does a good job of addressing that issue. Saw a movie this weekend, went with the family on Saturday, been wanting to see this, and since our canoe trip was canceled because of the weather, got to go to the Saturday matinee of Sully, which is a Clint Eastwood-produced film, directed and produced, starring Tom Hanks, one of my family's favorite actors, recounting the story of the so-called Miracle on the Hudson, the landing of the U.S. Air jet on the Hudson River in January of 2009, in which engines, because of a bird strike, went out and the plane had to be landed, at least Sully thought, the captain of the Chesley Sullenberger, the pilot of the huge plane, had to be landed on the water, and no people were killed. It was really quite a remarkable thing, and it's very dramatically depicted in the film when Captain Sullenberger takes the little handheld mic, and the first time the passengers have heard his voice, he simply says, "This is your captain, brace for impact." That's not what you want to hear from your pilot. Let me just say, it is a visceral sort of experience, some of the flight scenes in the film. But what struck me, and again, I highly recommend it. It's a very, very well done movie. I think one of Tom Hanks' better films. We got in a debate with my family. Do you like that film better or Captain Phillips, which is also a really gripping movie in which he plays the true story of the captain of the large freighter that was hijacked by Somali pirates. That's a great movie, too. But one of the things that struck me, because it was almost like the film depicted, in a sense, a secular canonization process. You know, the canonization process in the Catholic Church. Someone dies. There's a large consensus of those nearby that this person was a living saint. And yet the Church, in her reticence, you know, in her wisdom, goes through a process of opening a cause for canonization, of investigation, of having people who can give a contradictory voice to the sanctity of that person. That's sort of the way it played out in this film. You had, right after the miracle on the Hudson, it was almost like the chance of Santo Subito at John Paul II's death, sainthood now. He was viewed as a hero. But then the film portrays, which was were events that I don't know where I was, why I was tuned out to this, that there was a long investigation from the National Transportation Safety Board on this crash, as there are all crashes. And a lot of questions raised about whether he did the right thing in landing in the Hudson River, or whether he should have tried to make it to the airport at back to LaGuardia or an airport in New Jersey. And the film sort of leaves it dicey there for a while. You're not quite sure. And I'll kind of, you know, to avoid giving a spoiler, I'll avoid telling you how it ends. But it is a fascinating film, and it's very much, like I said, a secular reflection of the Catholic canonization process. Was Sully a hero, or was he a fraud? That's the question of the film. Now, the difference, of course, is, unlike the Catholic canonization process, Sully was around to defend himself, to explain himself. If you're a Catholic and the canonization process has started, that means you're not around to defend yourself. Very clear difference between the two. But it shows that we do have this craving in our culture for saints of one sort or another, and we also have this cynical tendency to want to pick them apart. Those are some of the random thoughts that went through my head watching that film. Let's go to random.org. Let's spin the Dollar Catechism wheel as we do this time every day. Go to this great repository of the faith and see what Providence has in store. 2,865 paragraphs. We've dialed up through random.org 1509. This is under the section Heal the Sick. This is under the sacrament, the anointing of the sick. Heal the sick. This church has received the church has received this charge from the Lord and strives to carry it out by taking care of the sick, as well as by accompanying them with her prayer of intercession. She believes in the life-giving presence of Christ, the physician of souls and bodies. This presence is particularly active through the sacraments, and in an altogether special way through the Eucharist, the bread that gives eternal life, and that St. Paul suggests is connected with bodily health. It, not for nothing is the Eucharist called the medicine of immortality. This basically is in this section on the anointing of the sick, helping us understand the church's concern for the sick, which is rooted in our identity as the body of Christ. Christ himself, who was a physician of souls and bodies, the great physician, as he's often called. And therefore, the church has a stake in the health, both spiritual and physical, of all those in her purview, which, of course, is every human person. God bless you. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Again, thanks to Shadi Hamid. Thanks to Luke Harrington for their presence on the show. Thanks for Alex running the board. We'll be back by God's grace tomorrow. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.